Stranger, today's episode touches on some difficult topics, including institutional child abuse, suicide, war, trauma, and sexual assault. Please take care while listening. Have you ever had a day where you thought to yourself, I should have just stayed in bed? Or maybe you have had days where you felt like you couldn't get out of bed in the first place, even if you sort of wanted to or felt you should? Have you ever tried to lift your limbs only to have them feel leaden and heavy, and then have your eyelids follow suit? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I am, admittedly, a very sleepy person, but even I am able to rouse myself when my personal, professional, or familial responsibilities, or just my self-respect, demand it. Take, for example, this very morning, when I honestly did not know how I was going to possibly get myself out of bed. It was only the calendar in my mind with its incredibly long list of to-dos that forced me, fairly kicking and screaming, out of the comfort of my bed, whereupon I fell to the floor, slithered into my office, and sat at my cluttered desk, choking back tears as I looked at the 57 tabs I have open on one of the 5 different internet windows I have going currently. These are not, I assure you, exaggerations, and pulled up one of the 3 scripts I'm working on, all the while wondering when I'll be able to get back into bed. It's going to be a long day. But mine are problems of my own making. The same cannot be said for the children I'll be talking about today, who, through no fault of their own, have been forced into such stressful situations that their bodies just shut down, sending them into a prolonged, deep sleep, doomed Disney princess type of malaise. Crawl under the covers, stranger, and join me as we look at a weird illness that put its victims under a very real sleeping spell. Strangers, my body is all jacked up, and I refuse to take a bunch of synthetic chemicals every night just to get to sleep. That's why I love cornbread hemp CBD gummies. They are a natural way to relieve aches and pains and discomfort. The CBD gummies from cornbread hemp are formulated to work with your body, not against it. Cornbread hemp CBD gummies are all third-party tested and USDA organic to ensure safety and purity. They're made to help you feel better, whether it's stress, physical discomfort, or just needing a little relaxation. Look, life is extra hard these days. We can use all the help we can get. Why not get that help in a natural, organic way with delicious CBD gummies from cornbread hemp? I really love these gummies, and I think you will too. Right now, Strange and Unexplained listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head to cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE at checkout. That's cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE. In 1998, a 17-year-old boy fled the First Chechen War and arrived in northern Sweden, where he and his family awaited a residency permit. Something unusual happened. The boy began to deteriorate. He went from being exhausted to being apathetic to being fully unresponsive, mimicking a catatonic state. It was unlike anything doctors had seen before. Sweden, in the 1980s and 90s, saw a sudden rise in immigration. Asylum seekers from countries like Lebanon, Syria, Turkey, Eritrea, and Somalia, among others, flocked to Sweden. Sweden, for example, and it may surprise you to learn, is home to the third largest Chilean community outside of Chile because so many Chileans moved there during Pinochet's dangerous, despotic regime. Later, waves of Iranians and Iraqis migrated to Sweden to escape the various conflicts in their countries. In the 1990s, there was also substantial immigration from the former Yugoslavia to Sweden as people fled the war-torn country in droves. Among these waves of immigrants were, naturally, many children. These were children who had lost their homes, often members of their families, too. These were children who were traumatized by the experience they had and the things they saw in the countries they were fleeing. It was in this population of refugee children in 1990s Sweden that the first documented cases of resignation syndrome were diagnosed. Now, if you're anything like me, you hear resignation syndrome and you go, oh yeah, I have that, just like I can't take this anymore. But resignation syndrome is a lot more serious than tapping out to binge the X-Files while the world around you falls apart. Resignation syndrome is something else, something awful and unique in that it affects only refugee, asylum-seeking, and humanitarian parolee adolescents around the ages of 8 to 15. And, for a long time at least, it seemed to only take hold in Sweden. Fun fact, the Swedish word for resignation syndrome is uppgivenhet syndrome. So, like, give up syndrome. The Swedish really have a way with words. I think this name really gets to the core of what people who have the syndrome are suffering with. Basically, refugee kids who had been through hell before they relocated to Sweden were deeply depressed and traumatized by what they went through. And, in spite of the pervasive belief that kids are resilient and can be fine no matter the circumstances, some of them just seem to give up. Fun side note about children and resilience, it wasn't until the 80s or 90s that Western medicine began to realize that kids were affected by the death of a loved one. White people, at least, actually thought that losing a parent, for example, just didn't affect kids. Perhaps this was because of the long-held pervasive notion that kids should be seen and not heard, and that crying was a sign of weakness? And so maybe kids conditioned themselves to keep their feelings inside, and as a result, grown-ups were like, see? Totally unbothered by the loss of their loved one. We were basically just like Hakuna Matata to generations of children who'd lost loved ones. We, as a species, can be incredibly myopic. Anyway, when I say refugees were giving up, I don't mean like throwing up their hands and saying, what are you gonna do type of giving up. Not even declaring I can't go on type of giving up. I mean just stopping everything. Resignation syndrome is also sometimes called traumatic withdrawal syndrome, traumatic refusal, or abandonment syndrome. And all of these names kind of circle the point. Resignation syndrome first manifests when patients become socially withdrawn, which I imagine can be difficult to even spot in some adolescents, as that seems to be what they start doing naturally at some point anyway. Also, for a kid experiencing acute trauma, withdrawing is probably pretty universal. The Christmas before my mom died, I retreated so hard into my Game Boy I practically became one with it. And yet, my parents didn't want me to go to therapy. The 90s were a weird time, strangers. While we all have our antisocial moments, the social withdrawal and resignation syndrome is followed by growing anxiety and depression characterized by apathy and lethargy. And again, I get it. I myself have been known to be anxious, apathetic, lethargic, and depressed. Frequently, the only reason I get out of bed is that if I don't do this show, my family doesn't eat. But here is where symptoms of RS start to diverge from those of the garden variety depressive. People with RS will keep descending, beyond where most of us think the rock bottom of our debilitating ennui is. RS sufferers withdraw deeper and deeper inward until they cease to be able to care for themselves. The condition can progress to the point where the patient falls into a stupor, becoming nearly catatonic. They stop talking and walking. These patients, these kids, like the Chechen boy, are so overwhelmed with hopelessness that they stop eating or drinking and have to be nourished through a feeding tube, sometimes for months or even years. They will become incontinent and completely unresponsive. As parents or caregivers look on helplessly, their children will pass into a coma-like state, becoming utterly helpless and dependent on others for care. I cannot, as a parent, begin to imagine how terrifying this must be to witness. On top of all the other horrors you're dealing with, fleeing your home under threat to your life, showing up in some completely foreign place, only to most likely be held in under-resourced refugee camps, and then having your child inexplicably descend into catatonia? How awful. The cure for all this? Oh, just a return to normalcy. Only a return of hope. How long the patient suffers with RS appears to be directly related to how long it takes to make them feel hope again, usually in the form of a visa approval. So imagine the distress of the Swedish medical community when, after the Chechen boy, other kids started to follow suit. And these devastating symptoms showed up in more and more of the young refugee population. According to an article in FrontiersIn.com, quote, from January 1st, 2003 to April 31st, 2005, 424 cases were reported. And out of the 6,547 asylum applications submitted for children in Sweden in 2004, 2.8% were thus diagnosed. No cases reported from other countries. The phenomenon appears unique to Sweden. End quote. Sweden, come for the chocolate, stay for the catatonia. Another article in The Sun from 2021 follows neurologist Suzanne O'Sullivan, who traveled to Stockholm to study two sisters suffering from the condition. O'Sullivan described the illness this way, quote, children initially became anxious and depressed. Their behavior changed. They stopped playing with other children and over time stopped playing altogether. They slowly withdrew into themselves and soon they couldn't go to school. They spoke less and less until they didn't speak at all. Eventually, they took to bed. If they entered the deepest stage, they could no longer eat or open their eyes. They became completely immobile. They ceased having any active participation in the world. End quote. O'Sullivan saw this firsthand when she encountered patients like Nola, a 10-year-old girl in Horndal, Sweden, who was one of several children O'Sullivan saw during her research into resignation syndrome. She describes her first time seeing Nola in a piece in the neuroscience periodical Nautilus. Quote, Nola was lying in a bed to my right. She was about 10 years old, I guessed. This was her bedroom. She was wearing a pink dress and black and white harlequin tights. Her hair was thick and glossy, but her skin was pale. Her lips were an insipid pink, almost colorless. Her hands were folded across her stomach. She looked serene, like the princess who had eaten the poison apple. I had come knowing what to expect, but somehow I still wasn't prepared. Five people and one dog had just walked into the room, but Nola didn't have so much as a flicker of acknowledgement for any of us. She just lay perfectly still, her eyes closed, apparently peaceful. The only certain sign of illness was a nasogastric feeding tube threaded through her nose, secured to her cheek with tape. The only sign of life, the gentle up and down of her chest. End quote. And then, are you ready for this, stranger? Quote, she's been like this for over a year and a half, Dr. Olson said as she bent to stroke Nola gently on the cheek. End quote. A year and a half. When I first started reading about this, I assumed we were talking about days or weeks. Months, maybe. O'Sullivan goes on in the article to describe her examination of Nola and Nola's sister Helen, who was about a year older and in an earlier stage of the illness, where she remained visibly conscious, lying quietly and unresponsive on her bed. Helen got sick, the article tells us, when her family's request for asylum was rejected for a third time. Quote, when the third rejection letter arrived, Helen said, "What will happen to my sister?" Then she became quiet and we saw she was getting sick. I told her parents not to let her stay in bed. I told them to make her eat and keep her in school, but it was impossible, end quote. O'Sullivan's examination of the children in their bedroom was limited and inconclusive. The first children affected with resignation syndrome underwent extensive examinations. Physicians ordered CAT scans, blood tests, EEGs, and spinal taps, but it soon became clear that the results were always normal. These unconscious kids had normal brainwave activity that reflected healthy waking and sleep activity. Eventually, it was decided it didn't make sense for the children to be in the hospital. After that, those who fell into RS were cared for by their families, like Nola and Helen. O'Sullivan, like all the doctors who ever examined patients with RS, found nothing abnormal about the girls aside from their catatonic states. Then, when she examined Nola's face, she discovered some interesting details. Quote, I tried to open Nola's eyes as Dr. Olson had and felt her resist. Dr. Olson asked me to palpate the muscles in her cheeks. In contrast to every other muscle in her small body, these were rigid. Her teeth were clenched shut. The posture of an RS patient is so still, so passive, that it is easy to assume there is nothing going on inside. The EEG says something different, but so did the tightness in the muscles of Nola's face. There was almost an element of determination in Nola's dissociative state. End quote. The post-immigration journey of Nola and Helen matters. The trauma of war, the trauma that followed, and the trauma of leaving to come to Sweden were all points on the timeline of their illness. These children, all the children with RS, were traumatized long before they fell ill. Nola was about 2.5 when she arrived in Sweden, or at least that is the age she was assigned. Somewhere in transit, her family's papers were destroyed and authorities had to estimate their ages. Lord only knows why the parents couldn't indicate their children's age with their fingers or on paper. Even with a language barrier, numbers are pretty universal, but that's not the point. They determined Helen to be 3.5 and their younger brother to be 1 year old. Babies, all of them. Nola and Helen's family are from a small ethnic group in Syria and Turkey known as the Yazidi. The Yazidi are no strangers to persecution. They have historically been the targets of genocidal massacres and, in modern times, continue to be the victims of attack. It pains me to say this, but it is not uncommon for Yazidi women and children to be sexually assaulted and abducted as sex slaves. About 70,000 Yazidi people have fled Syria and have sought asylum in Europe. I wish I could say Nola's family story was different. The story that O'Sullivan relates in her essay, though, makes my heart ache. The family lived in a rural village in Syria near the Turkish border. One morning, when Nola's mother went to the communal well to get water, she was dragged into the woods and assaulted by a group of 4 men. When she went home, she was accused of bringing shame to her family. Nola and Helen's grandfather, at one point, threatened to kill their mother. She had been pregnant when the assault happened. She lost the pregnancy. It was unsafe for the family to remain in Syria, so they fled to Sweden, where they applied for asylum. Asylum cases are hard. They rely on the applicant's ability to prove credible fear and persecution, things that can be very difficult to offer hard evidence of. You know, in a culture where people stubbornly refuse to just believe women, and in a culture in which rape is considered a shameful act on the part of the victim, I would imagine it is exceedingly rare for women to make that kind of thing up, even to gain asylum. In spite of Nola and Helen's family's repeated requests for asylum, they were rejected and eventually told to leave Sweden. This is when Helen started exhibiting symptoms of RS. What baffled O'Sullivan and others like her who were trying to understand RS was not just the terrible state of its victims, but questions like, why here? Why now? Dr. Carl Salen, a pediatrician researching RS for his PhD at the Astrid Lindgren Children's Hospital in Stockholm, was interviewed by the BBC and confirmed the specific locality of the disease, saying, quote, to our knowledge, no cases have been established outside of Sweden, end quote. He also said of one case study, quote, I can't make her better, because as doctors, we don't decide if these children can stay in Sweden or not, end quote. So why is resignation syndrome a strictly Swedish problem? Salen's take on it, in the BBC piece, is that, quote, the most plausible explanation is that there are some sort of socio-cultural factors that are necessary in order for this condition to develop. A certain way of reacting or responding to traumatic events seems to be legitimized in a certain context. So somehow, and we don't know the mechanism for this and why it should happen in Sweden, the kind of symptoms displayed by the children are culturally sanctioned. This is a way the children are allowed to express their trauma. If that is the case, it raises an interesting question. Could resignation syndrome be contagious? End quote. But also, not for nothing, children from these same countries have fled to other countries besides Sweden without descending into RS. So is it really the culture of origin, or is there something about Sweden, or refugee camps in particular? But something else I find fascinating about this is that if it is true, that means the ways in which we express illness can be informed by our culture or conditioning. And this speaks to the sudden or rapid growth of the condition. Sallin speculates, quote, "If you look at the very first case in 1998 in the north of Sweden, as soon as that case was reported, there were other cases emerging in the same area. And there have also been cases of siblings who first one develops it and then the other. But it should be noted that researchers who propose that model of disease, they are not certain that there needs to be direct contact between cases," end quote. Of course, when the cases first started to emerge, practitioners thought patients were faking or that the illness was a bid for attention. But these notions were quickly snuffed out as the case numbers grew. Maybe, it was speculated, it was a case of social mania, like the dancing plagues of the past. But RS didn't resolve in the relatively quick way that such phenomena did in the past. And it also didn't kill its victims. Despite not knowing much about RS, one thing that researchers came to understand was that the kids who suffered from the condition did eventually recover. An article from 2021 in the New York Times cites a Swedish psychologist saying, quote, "The children usually woke up after their families were granted residency, although not overnight," end quote. This seems like a very specific and difficult to come by antidote. So, short of receiving asylum, what kind of relief can patients of RS or their families expect? Restoring hope to the hopeless is not so easy, and it certainly isn't something the medical establishment is trained to do. One study, documented in the National Library of Medicine in a piece titled "Asylum-Seeking Children with Resignation Syndrome, Catatonia or Traumatic Withdrawal Syndrome," recounted the only known case of a young child with RS being deported while in the throes of the condition. Quote, "Only one case with resignation syndrome was deported back to the homeland, where there was no knowledge about the condition. The father had to feed his sick child through the tube with baby formula he'd bought himself during hospital stay and later at home. The tube clogged up, and this family returned after 4 months. The child was then severely dehydrated and in a worse condition than when he left. Permanent residency permit was obtained after another 7 months, and the child started to recover," end quote. In the case of Nola and Helen, they had lived in Sweden for longer than anywhere else when O'Sullivan met them. By then, they were facing deportation to Turkey, a country they did not remember and only knew from horror stories. There was no hope being administered to Nola and Helen. By the time O'Sullivan was studying RS, it was a well-known fact that when granted residency, the children impacted by the condition usually woke up. It was a gradual and slow process, but the kids did get better. In the case of one Ukrainian girl who had suffered from the syndrome and recovered, when asked what it felt like to have RS, she said it was like being in a dream that she didn't want to wake up from. When O'Sullivan wrote the piece in Nautilus a year after examining the two sleeping sisters, the girls had not awakened. This was a few years ago now. I couldn't find any updates to their condition. O'Sullivan left Sweden with as many questions as she had arrived with, and the only conclusion she seemed to arrive at was that she couldn't confidently say, as a neurologist, that RS could be classified as strictly a neurological disorder. Maybe this is what makes resignation syndrome so daunting, so difficult to categorize through any lens, whether medical or psychological. By now, there have probably been upwards of 1,000 cases of RS, but it's still not an officially recognized psychiatric condition in the eyes of the World Health Organization. The condition stands out from other depressive disorders by being so extreme in its effects and so elusive in its solution. What do you call it when one adolescent nervous system after another decides dissociation is an Olympic sport? Is it a variation of dissociative identity disorder, or DID, formerly known as multiple personality disorder? ClevelandClinic.org says, quote, "People with dissociative identity disorder may experience several different personalities, usually referred to as alters. Each identity may have different behaviors, memories, thought patterns, or expressions. The identities may have different ethnicities and ways of interacting with their environments," end quote. And, quote, "DID interferes with your ability to function in your day-to-day. It can impact your relationships with others and performance at school or work. DID is one of several dissociative disorders. These disorders affect your ability to connect with reality," end quote. So maybe RS is a version of DID where the dissociative personality formation is just a really unconscious one? And what about these other dissociative disorders? One such condition, known as depersonalization/derealization disorder, is a condition where the sufferer feels detached from their thoughts, feelings, and body, depersonalization. They also may experience a disconnect from their environment, derealization. Resignation syndrome seems like an extreme version of these dissociative conditions. What better way to detach from thoughts, feelings, body, and environment than to drift into a hypersomniac state? And what better reason to adopt these extreme coping mechanisms than unresolved trauma and extreme stress? According to ClevelandClinic.org, quote, "Dissociative disorders appear on the trauma spectrum, and many with a dissociative disorder may have co-occurring trauma-related mental health conditions," end quote. We know that those who suffer from resignation syndrome are traumatized. I'm no psychologist, but it doesn't seem like that much of a leap to consider that a child's brain and nervous system might be so overwhelmed by the stress and trauma of violence, fear, and environmental devastation that they might just go dormant as part of a survival instinct. So maybe RS isn't recognized, but if we can agree that this is part of a larger family of dissociative disorders, then maybe there is some context for dealing with it. But hey, what do I know? I'm just sleepy. I will say this. After avoiding really dealing with the death of my mother for about 10 years or so, I spent a lot of time sleeping. Like, a lot. I could sleep for 19 hours, get up to eat something, and go right back to sleep for another 23. Short of catatonia, I would say that's about as dissociative as one can get. Perhaps another reason the WHO has not recognized RS is that there are some other clinical diagnoses already on the books that appear similar to RS. One of those conditions is sleeping sickness, also known as African trypanosomiasis. The symptoms of sleeping sickness are very like RS at first glance. Excessive daytime sleepiness, nocturnal insomnia, walking difficulties, speech difficulties, and coma. The differences, though, abound. Sleeping sickness, for example, is known to be caused by a parasite called Trypanosoma brucei, spread by the tsetse fly. Can I just say that I have never heard one single good thing about a tsetse fly? Why did Noah let them on the ark? The CDC also says of the disease that after exhibiting headache, fever, weakness, and joint pain, quote, "Once the parasite that causes the disease crosses into the central nervous system, various neurological disturbances appear. The victim of the illness might experience sleep disorders and death," end quote. Yeah, so that is absolutely awful. But despite comparisons, it also doesn't sound like resignation syndrome at all. Resignation syndrome appears completely psychogenic in nature and, again, does not kill its victims. It just robs them of life for a while. Regardless of whether the WHO acknowledges this distinction or recognizes resignation syndrome at all, the condition and its link to the traumatic experiences of its victims have been documented since the 90s. And the results of that documentation tell us that uncertainty and fear play a particularly strong role in the condition. I dare say many of us these days are feeling more tired than we used to. We live in scary, uncertain times. It's not hard to imagine my exhaustion devolving into catatonia, and the fear of that makes me even more sleepy. Those of us who have never had to flee our country of origin to remain safe, and who have never had to witness firsthand the horrors of war, starvation, exploitation, abject poverty, or entrenched fascism, are privileged not to know this. But it is a fact that the asylum approval process can be long and arduous, and comes with uncertain results. Many who await approval are plagued with protracted anxiety that they will be rejected. Applicants often live with a constant fear of deportation. Imagine leaving horrific circumstances and arriving to safety only to find that the safe haven you struggled to find is itself deeply uncertain. Imagine always wondering if you will have to return to the dangers you escaped, always feeling that your safety is only temporary. Imagine knowing the place from which you escaped is now a pile of rubble. These are the mental conditions under which RS takes hold. Thank you. Over the years since RS was first documented, it has become clear to those who have seen it claim the consciousness of so many children that there is an urgent need for mental health support and intervention strategies to rehabilitate those who suffer from it. And it is also clear that the best defense, where RS is concerned, is a good offense. Preemptive and prophylactic mental health care is essential to keep the syndrome from affecting the vulnerable populations that have avoided it so far. Helping children build resiliency can provide a safety net within their own psyche when shit falls apart. Of course, it's probably next to impossible to build resiliency in the face of continual, protracted trauma. Whether the country of Sweden or its medical community is in a position to provide that care is another question. If only they had somewhere to look for guidance. But as practically no cases have been documented anywhere else, there is no precedent for treatment or intervention. Those dealing with the disease are starting from nothing and have little idea why they are alone in the fight. An article from The Economist in 2018 looked at other refugee communities with resignation syndrome in mind and did find a few occurrences outside of Sweden, specifically on the South Pacific island of Nauru, where about 800, quote, boat people were exiled to offshore processing centers by Australia. The Australian government, which has a strong stance against immigration, in some kind of agreement with Nauru, developed a practice, now deemed illegal, of taking asylum seekers who try to reach the country by boat and placing them in a kind of detention limbo on the island while they await asylum. The Economist article follows Doctors Without Borders, or Medecins Sans Frontières, which spent 11 months on the island, and their observations and concerns about resignation syndrome. Quote, "It is unclear, for example, why there have been no signs of the syndrome among migrants at Australia's other foreign detention centers. Cases which resembled resignation syndrome were recorded in Nazi concentration camps, but they were never formally identified as such. Doctors view the syndrome as a reaction to stress and hopelessness. This goes some way toward explaining its appearance on Nauru, where some boat people have been confined for 5 years as part of a process of indefinite detention that the UN has ruled illegal. Australia refuses to accept even those whose refugee claims have been approved and seeks instead to place them in other countries. MSF refuses to say how many of the children on Nauru may be suffering from traumatic withdrawal syndrome. A report published in August suggested there were at least 30. The National Justice Project, a legal center, has brought 35 children from Nauru this year. It estimates that 7 were suffering from traumatic refusal, another term for resignation syndrome." End quote. The article goes on to look at the conditions on the island. Quote, "Nauru's hospital is ill-equipped to deal with the litany of mental health problems already affecting asylum seekers. It has only one psychiatrist who does not speak English, and no beds are available for suicidal patients." End quote. Following the deluge of RS cases, conservative Australian politicians broke ranks and actually called for children to be removed from Nauru. Good for them. It's refreshing to see conservative politicians actually do something for the children they purport to care about. So it seems RS is not only a Swedish problem after all. And if it can happen on Nauru, and if it happened in Nazi concentration camps, as it sounds like it did, though there is little information about those cases, then it seems like it could happen anywhere that traumatized kids are living in hopeless and uncertain circumstances. The irony of the immigration experience, especially in the case of refugees and asylees, is that most people aren't born wanting to leave the place they come from. Those who seek to emigrate do so out of a profound need. Sometimes that is the need for more financial security and stability. Sometimes it is the need for freedom from persecution or the need for safety from harm. Anyone would seek these things if we did not have them. That is human nature. Yet there is such a stigma, such othering, ingrained in the process of asking for help from another nation when these basic needs are not being met. So the people forced into these circumstances are not just suffering the trauma of the situation they are leaving, they are also bearing the trauma of leaving that which is familiar and often beloved, of becoming social outcasts, of being deemed a burden rather than an asset to the new communities they are entering. Human beings are not built to absorb so much stress. Our minds and bodies will buckle under that weight, and we'll find ways to transfer that load somewhere else. Refugee populations are at a higher risk of substance abuse. Immigrants suffer from rising suicide rates following migration. Surprise, surprise. Leaving your country of origin is hard, and even harder when the situation there is bad. I wonder how bad things get when the situation you end up in is almost as bad as what you left. Like what happens when you jump out of the frying pan and into the fire, so to speak. The American Psychological Association reports that U.S. immigrant populations have been experiencing growing mental health issues since 2016, saying, quote, several studies revealed increases in panic attacks, anxiety, depression, feelings of vulnerability, and fear of encounters with immigration authorities, end quote. The article goes on to say, quote, while restrictive immigration policies negatively impact immigrant people's psychological well-being, they decrease the likelihood that immigrant people will receive the mental health care they need, end quote. And when those people are kids, the impact is even more complex. A paper published by the Society for Research and Child Development says, quote, children may be detained in government facilities or refugee camps that are both developmentally inappropriate and physically dangerous. The spread of disease in close quarters and instances of abuse at the hands of facility staff and other residents pose imminent physical risk to detained children. Children swept up in immigration proceedings must contend with a loss of autonomy, developmentally inappropriate environments, inadequate or inconsistent services, family separation, and risk of being lost in a complex nationwide system, among other adversities. The effects of these stresses are cumulative, so immigrant children who already faced adversity in their country of origin or in the migration process are more vulnerable to long-term consequences. End quote. No kidding, Bob. I wonder what the resignation syndrome statistics in ICE detention centers that hold children would be if anyone cared enough to look at them. But I guess we would have to have a functional CDC or NIMH to determine that, and those agencies are all but defunct now since recent executive orders have stripped funding and DOGE's massive firings gutted their personnel. Where is my DOGE check, by the way? Not to mention our politicians have shown us time and time again that they don't care about the mental health or even the physical health of children. If they did, we wouldn't have the equivalent of a school shooting a day in America. And those same politicians care even less about the well-being or traumatic experiences of refugees and asylees of any age in this country, as the current administration tries to violently, divisively, and illegally purge the nation of all immigrants, and some folks who just, to the white nationalists, look like immigrants. Are we approaching a situation in the U.S. where any and all people are gradually being exposed to traumatic circumstances? Are we becoming a nation of refugees from the applied fascism of our own federal government? Where does the cruelty stop? How far does the trauma go? Maybe we are all now just becoming resigned to a reality where dissociation is the best we can hope for. I don't know about you, stranger, but I need a long, long nap. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, we'll be bringing you two old bonus episodes that will be brand new for most of you. We'll learn all about Ouija boards and some spirits who allegedly came through them. This episode was written by Eve Kerrigan and me, Daisy Egan, with research by Joe Guardette, sound engineering and mixing by Anthony Abatangelo, music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. For more great content, including my other two podcasts, plus early ad-free Strange and Crimes of the Centuries, and a whole lot more, head to patreon.com/grabbagcollab. If you have a topic you'd like me to cover, head to the website strangeandunexplainedpod.com and fill out the contact form. I am way behind in getting back to emails, but I promise I will. You can follow Strange on Instagram and TikTok at SNUPod and join the Facebook group to join in the conversation. Also, if you're still listening, that means you're a diehard fan, so this is for you. I'm going to be doing some AMA episodes. You can DM me on Instagram or fill out the contact form on the website to ask me anything. Thanks, and stay strange.